Wales. Good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, and supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line from Colorado, Ron Brown. We're going to be talking about what's going on as far as the bond market is concerned. Now, I'm not a financial analyst, and neither is Ron, but of course we can make some observations on what's happening. And of course, while our attention is focused on the capture of Chemical Ali over in Iraq, and of course the continued loss of American troops, just a few a day, American, British troops being killed there in this police action, as you might want to call it at the present time. After all, we won the war, but of course, terrorists from all over the world are coming in. And of course, I'm sure that there are many of the supporters of Saddam Hussein who are still involved in this action against the American forces, which they feel are invaders there. And of course, we're there supposedly to restore freedom to the people, and yet of course we're not allowing them to elect their leaders. We appoint their leaders for them, and of course, we recently saw an occasion where there was a tragedy. There was an enclosure, and a number of Iraqi prisoners were there, and somebody starts lobbing mortar shells into this enclosure, killing Iraqis. Now, why would anybody, an Iraqi, want to be killing Iraqi prisoners? Certainly, that really doesn't make sense. I mean, who would benefit from something like that? And then, of course, the American commander said, well, we're not going to be intimidated by this killing of the Iraqis. The American troops are going to be here for a long, long time. And, of course, I've told you before that the plan is to permanently station American troops in the Middle East. That comes, of course, from the report of Rebuilding America's Defenses put out by the Project for the New American Century back in the year 2000, September of 2000. And everything that's happened was, of course, orchestrated and planned long, long before even George Bush was elected to the presidency. Well, it's about time that we realize, of course, while our attention is being focused elsewhere, important things are happening here at home. The globalization continues. Cannon mills are shut down. Major industries continue either shutting down or simply moving offshore here in the United States. And then we begin to see, of course, the stock market being artificially propped up. And you notice it sort of trades within a very, very limited, somewhere between 9,000 and 9,500. It just goes up and down, but it really doesn't seem to be going much of any place. And who's buying all the stocks? Well, we're really not very certain. Would the government rig the stock market? Of course it'd rig the stock market. You know, of the Federal Reserve System, of course that's not the government, that's a privately owned central bank, but they've convinced the American people it's an American institution, and it's not. It's simply an extension of the central bankers that control the economies of literally every government in the world today. And of course, we have, but there's another thing, and that's the bond market. And so Ron Brown has been working in financial sales for a long time. He's in the coin business and providing advice to people as far as what he thinks is going to happen as far as coins are concerned, and of course at least offering them for sale. But the important thing is, what is really happening in the bond market, Ron?
Well, first off, the bond market is the foundation on which we built this house of cards. You see, everything we call money today really is monetized debt. And so it really becomes kind of a Ponzi scheme, in that as we've built a debt structure year after year after year, what is the debt structure now? It's $7 trillion is the official debt. They're saying the unfunded liabilities are, what, $38 trillion? So as that debt structure gets bigger and bigger and bigger, it gets harder and harder to sustain. and yet that is the foundation on which we built this house of cards. So probably the best way to understand what's going on in the bond market is to kind of go back and do a little overview on how we got to the point we're at. And of course, already started with the fact that we went to a fractional reserve banking system when we created this thing called the Federal Reserve System, which, as you've said many times, is not federal and it's not government. And so it's just a private banking system who has been given the authority to accept as collateral government obligations or government debts, and to create money out of thin air, basically, and loan that money to the government at interest and to the people. So it's a pretty good deal for them. They're able to have a cost of goods sold to basically zero and then earn interest forever on it. So I think we'd all like a deal like that. But as this debt structure's gotten bigger and bigger and bigger, then it's getting harder to sustain. So if you look at that structure, it becomes a Ponzi scheme, as I mentioned, in the sense that you can never let that system contract. It must continue to grow, because you have to have more money in circulation every year to keep paying the ever-increasing debt structure.
Because there really isn't, of course, any real money to pay it off, and so you have to just keep creating more and more and more. And the latest figures I saw from Ron Paul was about $43 trillion overall in debt and monetary increments here in the United States. So it's up from about $38 trillion to $43. We're talking about a federal deficit of over $500 billion this year. And $500 billion, that's $500 billion. And, of course, they're not telling about all the money they're going to steal from Social Security and Medicare, and they'll just put that onto the national debt. That's another $250 billion. So we're really talking the one-year deficit will be in the neighborhood of $750 billion, $750 billion. Now, it took from 1789 until 1980 to run up $1 trillion in debt. I mean, if Ronald Reagan increased that debt by $1.7 trillion in 8 years of office, about $200 billion a year in the 8 years he was in office, which was terrible. And by the time he left the presidency, our national debt was $2.7 trillion. George W. Bush, it will not be outdone, though. Nobody has ever accomplished what he has, creating a national debt within a one-year period of almost $750 billion. And as they say, it took from 1789 to the year 1980 to run up $1 trillion in debt.
That's right. So, see, as this thing gets bigger and bigger and bigger, you can't let it collapse. But in year 2000, March, remember when the dot-com bubble burst? That destroyed somewhere, around $6 to $8 trillion worth of paper wealth that had been built during the bubble time.
But there wasn't anything behind the wealth. It was just all, it was all a mirage, as it were.
Sure. But the point being is you have to keep the system growing, and when that bubble burst, it destroyed $6 to $8 trillion worth of paper wealth. And any way you want to cut it, that is a major contraction in the money supply and circulation. So that forced the Fed to go into an inflationary mode, because you hear them talking, all they're worried about now is deflation, and they need to be worried about deflation, because the laws of economics are trying to collapse this unsustainable debt structure and bring it down, and of course the powers to be in control are desperately trying to hold it together. So after 2000, they started the printing press rolling, and as you both know, especially out in California, the major way they've kept the printing press going is through the real estate market, bringing interest rates ever lower, using Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to just create more and more money by monetizing the real estate. And so that has kept the bubble going for all these years, at least the last 2 or 3 years. But see, that's a bubble too. You can't keep interest rates going lower forever.
And in fact, the interesting thing is what they've done. They're encouraging people, and you'll hear the ads on the radio or television, refinance your house. The rates are lower now than ever before. Get the money out of your house. And so people are refinancing their house and coming up with $20,000, $60,000, $100,000. Now they can go out and spend that as if there is to no tomorrow. But the problem is, Ron, what happens if the price of real estate falls, as it is falling in communist China today, as it's fallen in Japan, and pretty soon the house is worth less than the debt on the house. At that point, why would anybody want to keep a house if they were actually paying off a house that wasn't worth what they were paying on? Easiest thing would be to just walk away and leave that house and let somebody else be stuck with a massive debt.
But see, that's why the policy out of Washington basically is inflate or die. They have to keep the inflation going, because you're right, if it ever starts back down, it will go into a black hole very, very quickly. So no matter how desperate they become, I think they will find a way to try to inflate their way out of it. So back to my analogy, see, as they keep this printing press running faster and faster and faster, then it has the effect that it always has with the fiat currency, and that is people start to lose faith in the currency. You just can't print enough money for everything and create real wealth. So what's finally started to happen is the dollar started to go down in the world markets, and at one point here about 2 months ago, the euro or the dollar had dropped almost 30% versus the euro and 20% against all the currencies across the board. So that is the world saying, we're not going to sit here and hold your paper as you devalue it through inflation.
Well, it's interesting. Of course, the price of silver has gone up about 10%. The price of gold has gone up not quite that amount. Platinum is doing very, very well. So all of these items seem to be going up in value, or maybe they're just holding their value, and of course the value of the dollar is going down, so they appear to be going up.
Well, as they print faster and faster, you're going to see the cost of all things going up, and that's a deception that I want to talk about in a few minutes. I think it's going to come across America that's going to fool most of the people. But let me finish my analogy here. So as the dollar continued to drop, by definition, that means foreigners or someone must be dumping their dollars, right? If the dollar is dropping 30%. Now, foreigners own 40% of our treasury bonds, so we're getting back to the bond market, which is where we started. If the Fed were to allow those bonds to be dumped by Germany and whoever around the world into the market unwanted, then the bond market would start to go down very sharply, right?
Right.
When the bond market goes down, by definition, interest rates go up. So if interest rates go up, what happens to the real estate bubble?
It pops with a loud, resounding bang.
That's right. So that's their dilemma. And see, they have to run the printing press because they can't let it go into a deflation. But as they run the printing press faster and faster and faster, then they start to devalue the currency, and the foreigners that own our paper start to dump those dollars into the market, or those treasury instruments, which are treasury bonds.
And of course, then the only way they're going to get anybody to buy those bonds is to raise the interest rate on them, and then people, of course, they can get a decent return, they'd buy them. But, you know, who wants to buy our bonds when the interest rate is so low?
Right, and the point is, if the interest rates go up, that destroys the real estate bubble, and that's what's holding this house of cards together. Plus, the whole corporate sector, as we know, is in massive debt. In fact, everyone's in debt. Even the citizens of America are in debt up to their gills. And if you see interest rates go up, then it's going to be harder and harder to fund and finance your deficits or your debt. So that is really their dilemma. Now, what I found interesting is that as the foreigners were dumping and as the dollar was dropping up to 30% over like a year's period, I found it very interesting that the bond market was holding steady. And so it could only mean one thing, is that the Fed could not allow the bond market to go down. So what was it doing? It was stepping in to repurchase those bonds that were being dumped from overseas and by astute people in this country. So that's kind of like going to a bonfire and trying to put it out with gasoline. You see, you don't solve an inflation problem by inflating. But that's what they had to do, because they had to try to keep the bond market from collapsing. But see, that is not going to last for long. And after about 6 or 7 months, finally the world caught on to what they were doing, just running the printing press. So what happened? The bond market collapsed anyway. And the bond market has just dropped 15% in a six-week period.
Virginia is down 15%. Of course, I don't watch the bonds that closely, and I know you do. So, of course, as the bond market has gone down, what's happened to the interest rate? It really hasn't gone up as high as anybody anticipated, has it?
Well, we're just at the very early stages of it. The mortgage rates have gone from, what, around 5% up to 6.25%. I don't track that every day, but you've seen the trend has turned from downward to upward, and that's enough to prick the real estate bubble, because the refi bubble requires interest rates to keep going lower and lower so people can go back every 2 or 3 years and refinance. And see, it looks like we're coming to an end of lower interest rates. And at the very least, interest rates are going to stabilize and start heading a little bit higher. My gut feeling is they're about to explode to the upside, but it's not going to happen probably as fast as we expect for this reason. Foreign central banks have 75 to 80% of all their reserves invested in U.S. dollars. So they have our treasury bonds, our treasury bills, our real estate, our corporate bonds, and so forth. They own them. And so if you have 80% of your money tied up in the dollar, which amounts to somewhere around $6 to $8 trillion, then you just don't walk up to the teller and say, cash me out.
Because, of course, they feel that there might be a run on the dollar, and that would mean that they would certainly get far less in return for the bonds that they hold.
That's right. If they collapse the dollar, then they don't get their money out of the market. So in that sense, they're in the same lifeboat with us, whether they like it or not. And so they're going to try to gradually phase away from independence on the U.S. for trade and on the dollar for their investments and try to slowly get it out. But as they slowly get it out, where are they going with that money? They're going to euros, they're going to gold, they're going to the dinar in Malaysia.
Well, now, go ahead.
And in other words, they're just diversifying gradually out of dollars into other currencies. So in effect, the United States is being dethroned as the world's reserve currency.
Well, now, what's happening to gold dinar? And of course, this is being set up by the Muslim countries as an alternative to the American dollar, really an attack almost on the American dollar, retaliating for what they perceive is, of course, America's attack on Islam.
Well, they're slowly setting the stage for it, just like the euro. 4 or 5 years ago, no one really took the euro serious. And it was just seemed like folly, and remember, if you'll recall, the dollar was just all super powerful, so the euro was not even a threat. Well, the people in power knew exactly what they're doing. They were slowly setting the stage for it, and then once they set the stage, see, now all they have to do is start dumping their dollars and going to euro, and suddenly the euro becomes the strongest currency going. And that the same thing could happen to the dinar if the OPEC nations choose to start pricing their oil, not in dollars, but in dinars and euros or some basket.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is, of course, that the Muslim countries, within their religion, is this position that you should not, of course, loan money and collect interest on it. That would be, against the dictates of the Quran. You probably know that better than I do, but that's my understanding. And so they've always been more prone to hold gold or hold something of fixed value. And then here in the United States, where we've accepted that a piece of paper with something printed on it is something of intrinsic value. So, you know, if they start going to a gold-backed currency, wouldn't this, of course, challenge the supremacy of the American dollar as the reserve currency of the world?
Absolutely. That's what I suggest is happening. The dollar is gradually being dethroned as the world's reserve.
Well, of course, if that should happen, wouldn't there be a terrible rush of dollars back into the United States?
And I think that's exactly what's starting to happen. But the Fed is buying them back right now to cover it up, so they don't just get dumped into the market.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back here in just a couple of minutes with our friend Ron Brown. If you have a question for Ron, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Ron Brown. And, of course, we're talking about money. We're talking really about the history of what's happened to other economies that have turned to a fiat type of money system. We saw that, of course, in ancient Greece, when, of course, they went off to, away from a gold system to a fiat money system, and eventually their economy collapsed. In Rome, of course, about 300 A.D., Diocletian split the empire, the Roman Empire, into two parts. One part went to Constantinople. The other half of the empire remained in Rome. Of course, Rome debased its currency, and of course, with that, of course, all the moral breakdown that is described in Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire took place. And of course, in the late 400 ADs, 475, somewhere in there, the Roman Empire was overrun by the Huns. But in Constantinople, where they kept a stable currency, the gold dinar was their currency, and they had a gold-backed currency. That society there, the Byzantine Empire, lasted until about 1200, well into the 1200s. And, of course, it was only then, of course, they were actually overthrown by the Muslim hordes moving north. So you can see the influence of a stable currency on the stability of society. Now, unfortunately, we have a wonderful, prosperous society, but of course that prosperity is built upon a fiat money system, and I don't know of any incidents in all history where a fiat money system has lasted for any period of time. How about you, Ron?
I think the history is clear. Every fiat system in the history has collapsed totally, so that's where we're heading, and the only question is how long will it take, and you know, when will it erupt into a chaotic situation instead of just a gradual demise.
You don't think that's why the FEMA is setting up all those relocation camps across America, just in case they will be some chaos that they suspect will come, having nothing to do with Islamic terrorism, because we're not having any Islamic terrorist attacks in America. Now, they're modern. They know where all the Islamic terrorists are. They've infiltrated their organization long ago. But, of course, they are setting up these relocation camps, spending billions of dollars to build them, and they must be anticipating some major cataclysmic event here.
Absolutely. You know, I think it'd be interesting to go back and look at how, in my opinion, America got sucked into a trap, at least the people of America, and that is this artificially strong dollar and this 20-year financial boom and bubble that it became. And, you know, if you think back to 1982, right after the inflationary blow-off of the Jimmy Carter and years, you know, the guns and butter of Johnson and so forth, and we'd gone into this inflationary binge, and it finally erupted into a crisis, and gold went to 870, and silver went to $52. If you recall, interest rates were 21.5% in late 80s. The bond market, by the way, in that period dropped 40% in a three-month period in late 79. Actually dropped 55% for the year in 1979. So, you know, people that are thinking bonds, and the bonds have been a wonderful place to be for the last 5, 10, 15 years, but everything has a cycle, and the people that hang on to their bonds could really get you know, devastated over the next year to two as inflation goes higher and interest rates eventually have to spike.
And, of course, when the interest rate goes up, why, the value of the bonds goes down. It's sort of a reverse relationship, isn't it?
Exactly.
All right, we're going to just have to wait here for a moment as our guests up there in the Great Northwest return, and then we'll welcome your calls here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest this evening is Ron Brown. If you have any question or comment, do you agree or disagree, give us a call, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Now, everybody says things are really great. You know, we're told that, you know, certainly we're doing very well over there. We're going to, you know, provide a wonderful democracy for the Iraqi people, and of course hope that this new society we're creating in Iraq is going to be sort of a beacon for all the other Arab countries, the Muslim countries, to want to emulate this and establish democracies in their own nation. Now, why they wanted to establish a democracy when America was a republic, and of course a democracy was the last thing our founding fathers wanted, certainly beats me. But all we can say is that this is what we're told. We're doing a great job over there. And yet, of course, a tremendous expense here in the United States. And my concern is that we're trying to spend ourselves into prosperity. You can do that for a time, But when you get a massive, massive debt, and then you have to pay interest on that debt, and then, of course, the interest rates begin to go up, that, of course, increases your interest payment. And, of course, pretty soon you get to the point where you have such a large debt, there's just no way to fund it. Is that a possibility?
Well, yeah, other than through hyperinflation. And, of course, that ultimately destroys the society, the whole fabric of society, as they had in back in Germany in 1921, for example. But if I can digress, let me get back to the analogy of how we got in this trouble. So remember in 1982, we were on the verge of a depression. Reagan was in office. Interest rates were still jockeying up and down very high by the summer of 82. There was tremendous talk about the United States going into a 29-style depression. The markets were down and the economy was slowing. And on June the 21st is when we really started this bubble. And that's when President Reagan came out and basically said, I'm paraphrasing here now, damn the torpedoes, we're going to print our way out of this mess. And so when he started the printing press rolling, that got the stock market going and started to create another round of prosperity. But I think the thing that made that possible is the simple fact we've all heard the saying that when the United States gets a cold, Europe catches pneumonia. So the whole world was desperate to get their economies going, and they desperately needed to trade with the United States, which was the largest consumer nation in the world. And so what were all the nations doing? Japan wanted their Hondas to look more attractive than Buicks, so they would orchestrate their currency lower versus the dollar. And they did that by selling yen to turn around and buy U.S. Treasury paper, in other words, buy dollars, and that made the dollar seem strong. Well, now Germany, of course, wants their Volkswagens to compete with the Honda, so what do? They have to lower their currency as well. So the whole world was stumbling over itself, lowering their currencies artificially versus the dollar, making the dollar all-powerful. And so we started going to these massive trade deficits as we were buying things around the world for dirt cheap because the dollar was so artificially strong. Now, see, that did two things. One, it covered up the inflation. See, most Americans think inflation is higher prices. That's what we're conditioned to think. Inflation, of course, is the increase in the money supply and credit. So while they were inflating radically during that period, it didn't show up in terms of prices because the dollar was so artificially strong and we were buying foreign goods for cheaper. So all this inflation was not showing up in terms of prices. And so that just gave us the euphoric feeling that everything was wonderful. The dollar was strong, our economy was going good, the markets were powerful, and it just became giddy and turned into an absolute, a bubble that had to eventually pop. And that's what started us on this downward spiral. But we had one heck of a binge for 20 years.
We certainly did. And, of course, everybody really felt, of course, it was going to go on forever. I could remember people talking about, the stock market going to 20,000. It was 11,000. And of course, people were even saying, why, we might even do what the Japanese did. Their stock market went to 40,000
right
before it collapsed.
Right. But the... And that's what always happens in manias. People get so wrapped up in these profits. Everyone was going to retire in 2 years. Just give me one more year of these profits, and I'll tell them to take this job and shove it. And I'll go into prosperity and live on my yacht. And of course, it collapsed.
Well, of course, the thing is that the people on the inside knew it was going to happen. It was just that the average individual did not. And, of course, what happens during these periods of economic crisis is the transfer of wealth from weak hands to strong hands. The strong hands know what's going to happen. The weak hands don't. And, unfortunately, why, of course, that's when our people are impoverished. It's happened over and over again. I fear it will happen again in the very near future. We'll be right back here in just a few minutes with Ron Brown. And we'll welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, Dr. Stan here. I don't know where that music came from, but we'll sort of ignore it. Anyway, let's get back to our special guest this evening, Ron Brown. Ron, you put out some sort of a newsletter, don't you? Would you like to tell our listeners how they can get that?
Yeah, I did a special report on silver a few years back, and it's still as valid today as it was back then. If they want it, they can call me at 1-800-595-0561.
1-800-595-0561. All right, well, let's, what is happening to silver? Silver's up about 10% from $4.50 up to about $5. Then it did back. I haven't watched it in a few days. What's silver actually doing at the present time?
Silver is acting very, very strong, Dr. Stan. Keep it in mind that the bankers are desperately, and have been for years, manipulating the price of gold and silver. And one of the ways they do this is by going into the futures market when there's demand for silver, and they start selling contracts into the market to suppress the price. And when you realize that the price of silver comes off of the COMEX, or the commodity market, that if they can suppress the price there, then the perception is that they've held the price of silver down. And so over the last 3, 4, 5 weeks, see, silver has been going up and gets up close to the $5 level, and then they beat it down into 440, 430, and it would come back up. And it's been doing this like for 2 years. And finally, about a month ago, it broke through 5, ran to 525, and held its price for about a week. And yet the powers to be just kept selling into the market until they forced it down to about 492, but it just keeps popping right back up. So they can't knock it down this time. And then in their attempt to beat it down, the short position, this is where the bankers like Morgan Chase and so forth go into the market and sell these contracts. They've sold something they don't have to deliver. And by definition, theoretically, they have to repurchase at some point to cover their shorts. They are now short. In order to beat the silver down, they increased their short position from 150 million ounces, added over 40,000 contracts. That's 200 million ounces of silver they sold into the market to beat the price down. According to Ted Butler, who is the expert on tracking what these guys do, he now says the insiders are short the market approaching 900 million ounces.
Well, wait a minute. They're only about, 100 million ounces in the COMEX?
Yeah, of course. In fact, it's worse than that, Dr. Stan. Of that 100 million ounces, only 36 million ounces of that silver is deliverable. In other words, if you bought a contract, a 5,000-ounce contract, and decided just to store that silver on the COMEX, that doesn't mean you really want to sell it. You may just want to store it there. So just because it's on the COMEX doesn't mean it's available to the marketplace. So we're really down to the lowest level of silver that we've had in the history of this country.
Well, of course, this could be a time when you could really get, somebody could get caught into a very, very bad position. But a saying about selling short, he who sells what isn't his and has to give it back or go to prison. Now, I can't imagine them putting the international financiers into prison for selling short, but of course they either have to change the rules of the game, which they have done, I've seen repeatedly through the years.
Sure.
Of course, when the big guys are going to get stuck, they just change the rules of the game.
That's right, because you better believe these people who are short are not doing it to make a profit. They're doing it for only one reason, and that is to hold the price down. And so who are they doing it for? They're doing it for the central bank. So they, in effect, in my opinion, are just surrogates.
Now, Chris, I think the reason that the American people must understand that the reason that they have kept the price of gold and silver down is because they want to force us to actually utilize their paper money. The central banks control the majority of the gold of the world. Now, if gold is of no earthly use, why do they control all the gold? Because if they control the gold, what are we going to exchange back and forth in the process of commerce? We have to use their currency. So they're really pretty smart about this. They understand how it all works, and they keep telling us gold is an archaic metal. It doesn't matter. It's no use anymore. That's why we're keeping it all. And there's something wrong with this.
Right. He who owns the gold makes the rules.
Right.
So, yeah, that's... And gold and silver, see, become the barometer of confidence in the paper system. So when gold is rising, that's sending a message to the world, there's something wrong in Mudville, there's something wrong with the currency, so you better take care. But if you can hold the price down, then people are oblivious, you know, to what's really going on, and they think everything is going fine. In reality, it's not.
Well, of course, the thing that, you know, impresses me at this time with the falling dollar, I would expect the world price of silver to be going up relative to the dollar. The world price isn't actually going up. It's simply reflecting the falling dollar. And so, you know, if it actually, if you were to put this into or have it sold in euros or in dinars or whatever you would want, the price isn't really going up. It simply appears to be going up as far as the falling dollar. Would that be a fair statement or not?
Yeah, you have to, and by the way, that'll get us into my, remember I said I want to talk about the deception that I think is going to come across America?
Right.
When you look, you know, Americans are all conditioned to think in terms of what was the percentage increase of my portfolio. So this is an example. Let's say a person had $100,000 in their stock portfolio today, and 12 months from now, lo and behold, it's $110,000. And so right off the bat, you know, we would logically think, hey, I've done pretty good. This is a slow economy and a recession. I've just made a 10% return on my money, so I'm doing pretty good. And is he? You know, you don't really know the answer to that question until you say, what is the value of the dollar? Now, if the dollar just lost 25% of its value, then obviously a 10% return didn't keep up with the treadmill. But see, most, I don't think Americans will see what hit them until 2-3 years down the road. They're going to say, I don't understand. I have more money in my account than I've ever had, and yet I'm broker than I've ever been. Because the money is being depreciated so fast that it's wiping out their lifelong savings. And, you know, that's what happened in Germany. In Germany, you reached a point when it got to the extreme that people who had saved money for 20, 30, 40 years, when they called the savings institution to get their savings out, they were given the answer, the standard answer was, I'm sorry, but your lifelong savings will not pay for the postage stamp to send it back to you. Now, obviously, that's the extreme. But then if you look at the dilemma, they really have no choice but to print because they cannot allow going into deflation because it's like a black hole that'll end very, very quickly, just like the 29 banking panic. See, that was over very, very quickly, and that was a pure deflationary collapse. They will not allow that to happen again.
Well, I think that they are, you know, I'm always amazed at, you know, when you have the power to create money out of nothing, how well you can manipulate the economy, at least for a time. But I think we're really entering uncharted waters because no country in the history of mankind has ever had a debt that's similar to what we have today. And this figure of whether it's 38 trillion, as Ron said, or 43 trillion, as I read recently, it really doesn't matter. They have actually increased. It was about 38 trillion. And I know that it increased about 5 trillion. Now, when I started looking at it, it was up to 41. And now, of course, and this was just in a matter of three years. And then it was up to another couple of trillion since that time. So they're churning out money like it's just, there's no tomorrow.
Yeah, and see, we really collapsed back in 78, 79, and they reprieved the way I was talking about it. And we've done this last 20 years, this last gasp of prosperity has been done, borrowed money from foreigners. And now the foreigners are rejected. So all of a sudden, for 20 years, the foreigners were basically saying to Americans, look, don't you worry about financing your deficits. We'll do that for you. You just come buy our Hondas and our Volkswagens and our goodies, and we'll just finance your folly. But well, now, all of a sudden, those dollar investments are collapsing on them, so now they're heading for the exits, and all of that debt that we put off and let someone else shoulder for the last 20, 30, 40 years is suddenly starting to come back on our shoulders at a time where our economy there's no way we can finance it ourselves.
And I think it's really, people have to actually realize that we are exporting our major industries. This is being done intentionally and purposely as we move our factories to Mexico and now primarily into communist China, where, of course, we have a excess labor force that will work very efficiently, for very little money. In fact, even both Japan and South Korea are sending many of their factories over to China to get the goods produced there. And so many of the parts that are used, even in some of our sophisticated weapons, our guided missiles and our guided bombs, are actually produced in communist China today. And so, of course, as they become the industrial powerhouse of the world, and this is coming, there's just no question at all that very soon China will be the industrial powerhouse of the world. And at that point, of course, what happens to the economy of the United States?
Right. And, of course, we can buy things cheaper because it's made with slave labor. Unfortunately, we don't have a job to have any money to buy things the way we're heading. There is another interesting thing going on in China with respect to silver in particular, and that is, see, over 20 years as we shipped all of our plants over there and sold it back to us, and they've been creating these massive surpluses of dollars. And keep in mind, around the globe, the foreigners have somewhere around $6 to $9 trillion of U.S. Paper instruments. That kind of puts us at their mercy, doesn't it?
I know. I think this year our trade deficit with China is $106 billion. And of course, we export about $6 billion worth of material to them, and they export about, $112 billion of material to us, but there are $106 billion more exports to us than we are to them.
Right.
We keep telling the American people, isn't it wonderful? Those Chinese are going to buy all of our products. They're going to buy our airplanes. They're going to buy our expensive cars. And anybody who believes that, well, I think they deserve to lose what they have, because we've been lied to over and over and over again. When are the American people going to understand that? You can tell when the politicians are lying because their lips are moving.
That's right. But see, as they've accumulated all these hundreds of billions of dollars of surpluses, now we're at their mercy. They can decide to sell their dollars and buy dineros or buy euros or buy whatever. But one thing they have done, which is very interesting, is a couple of months ago, the Chinese government opened up what's called the Shanghai Exchange, where the first time since the communists took over, the Chinese people are now being allowed to buy physical gold and physical silver. And the receptions to this, from what the reports I'm getting, have been phenomenal. One report I read said over the last 2 or 3 months since they've opened it, they're averaging over a million ounces of silver per day. Now, if you put that in perspective, what we were talking about, what is the available silver on the COMEX? And you said 100 million ounces, but really 36 million ounces of it is available for delivery. And here is China, who for the last 2 years, according to the people who report on the silver, China has been supplying 50 to 60 million ounces of silver to the free world to take up the slack in the shortfall. So that's what kept silver from going through the roof, let's say, over the last 2 years. Well, if suddenly they're saying, hey, we're going to allow our Chinese people, our citizens, to buy this silver instead of shipping it overseas, you see the potential impact that could have very, very quickly on the silver market.
How much silver? Do you have any idea how much silver is used in commerce? In other words, in film and in electronics and all the other things silver is used for today? I know it's used it used to be used, of course, in purifying water and water desalinization plants. Are they still doing that?
What's
silver used for?
There's a whole industry developing around the use of silver as a biocide. We've all heard about colloidal silver, but they're putting it in fabrics, they're putting it in utensils in hospitals, and they're putting it in the paint, they're putting it into, in other words, anything that has the silver in it, it kills the microbes and the bacteria. So they're putting it in filter systems in all the hospitals. Silver as a biocide is growing rapidly. It's becoming a multi-billion-dollar industry. But there's just all sorts of uses for silver. An interesting one, in fact, one of my clients called today, and this one could really just turn the silver market on its heels. We all know about the blackout in the East Coast, right? Mm-hmm. And someone called and said, Congress just proposed a $100 billion project to restore our electric power. But guess what they also said? It will be done with superconductivity materials. You see, that's one of the newest applications for silver. The science has known for years that if you could get the temperature of the conducting medium down to somewhere around 0 degrees centigrade, that you would increase dramatically the efficiency of the transmission, of electrical transmission. But how do you get the temperature down to 0 degrees centigrade? And the way they've done it is they take a nitrogen compound and somehow ensheath it totally in silver. The latest I heard in a report from the Silver Institute is it takes a ton of silver per mile of wire.
But now, is this really something that they could actually do, especially if the price of silver was going to go up, that would make it prohibitively expensive?
Well, but what does it cost to build a whole new power plant? You see, so if you could increase the efficiency of what you have through the superconductivity, and don't get me wrong, I'm not an expert on this, but that's what the congressman said. We'll have to use superconductivity to accomplish this.
And is there anything that will produce superconductivity besides silver?
Not that I know of.
Okay, fine. Well, one of our...
That alone could be hundreds of millions of new ounces of new demand. So you tie that in with what's going on in China and what's going on in the superconductivity. And as we all know, maybe we don't all know, but several months ago, Congress issued an order to study the use of silver to replace the arsenic compounds that are used in preservation of wood and so forth. So that alone could be another 100 million ounces. So the demand for silver, and the point is, the demand for silver with as technology increases, silver is the technological metal of the new age, of our age. And so the demand is going to continue to grow. And all this hype that silver is being replaced in photography, so therefore there's no demand for silver. See, that's just all hype to cover up what's really coming down.
Well, you know, when the digital pictures are really beautiful that they come off of the computers, but I can't help but wonder: is there any silver in those pictures? Something has to provide the color, the ink that is used there to give the vivid pictures that come off of your computer.
Well, the problem that they're developing in that arena is that the pictures come off pretty good, and if that was the case, you could say they're going to continue to compete and replace the silver photography. The reality is, and it's starting to come out now, is that these prints do not maintain. They deteriorate over just a few years. And of course, when people take pictures, they're for all time's sake, and they want them to pass them down. So now they're realizing they have to come back in, and if you want to save those pictures, you got to go back in and use silver processes to give you a picture that'll last.
One of our callers just called in and asked if you see the possibility of a two-tiered dollar system, if you think that perhaps the new colored money that they're coming up with may very well be a program anticipating some serious problems with the dollar, and of course they would want them to have an international dollar and a domestic dollar very similar to what they did in certainly in South Africa when I would live there. And of course the South African currency was chaotic, but the international rand was had a certain element of stability, so people were willing to trade that. Do you anticipate that, or do you see that as a possibility?
Well, a bill was first, and I wrote it up in one of my newsletters back in 1995. Senator Patrick Leahy actually introduced the bill to do exactly that. You would have an international dollar, which could be used outside of the borders of the U.S. only. It couldn't be used in America. And then you would have the domestic dollar, which could be used only inside our borders. And so by definition, if you do that, you just automatically put currency exchange controls where people can't take their money outside of the country to begin with. But that bill went through committee. The last I heard, it had passed committee, and they had it on a shelf somewhere. And that's probably got some dust on it from there, but it would take 2 or 3 seconds in the right environment to just bring that bill right out, put it on fast track, because this is an emergency. And certainly we can certainly see emergency coming in the near future with what's going on with the foreigners flooding out of the dollar.
Well, of course, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. If you have a question or comment, why, we'd love to hear from you. Again, what is your telephone number if people want to get that report from you?
1-800-595-0561.
1-800-595-0561. Okay. And, of course, really, I think these are really very, very difficult economic times we're moving into. I think that our attention is being diverted to so many different things that I don't think the average individual is capable of focusing on what's really taking place today. Well, we've got a caller here, and let's see who that is. One from Santa Cruz. Hi, who do we have on the line? Are you not using your name?
Anonymous.
All right, Anonymous. Go ahead.
No, this is Tony.
Oh, Tony. Okay, fine.
Hi. I read the other day on the internet that Ron Paul has sponsored a bill to outlaw the legal tender laws. And I was just wondering if you think that there's any possibility of this passing.
Well, now, what in effect was the outlawing legal tender laws? Because, of course, our currency used to say this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private, and is redeemable in lawful currency at any branch of the U.S. Treasury or any Federal Reserve Bank. And then one day, you wake up and you look at the bills and they say, this note is legal tender for all debts, public and private, period. Not redeemable in anything. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, if the legal tender laws are repealed, then people do not or would not have to accept paper money as far as in payment of debts.
All right.
We have to accept it in payment of debt.
All right.
That's the legal tender law.
What are your thoughts on that, Ron?
Well, bless his heart, I love Ron Paul. He is the guy that has stood there in the breach for 15, 20 years. And I think he has all the right answers, but obviously they won't let that go through. They couldn't let it go through. But they will declare, and you know, that may be where this dual currency comes in. They're going to declare some type of emergency because what the caller is saying is right. People are trying to reject, they're starting to reject the dollar, especially around the globe. So they're going to have to do something to deal with that. And of course, Ron Paul has the right answer, but he's one out of 435 in Congress. Maybe there's four or five others that would go along with him, but unfortunately, as much as I would like to see it happen, it won't.
And I think, Tony, that they're not going to address the issue until we're in a chaotic situation. Then at that point, I think you're going to see a massive transfer of wealth from weak hands to strong hands once again.
Right.
One interesting thing I was reading the other day was the case of Blanchard versus Barrick Gold, the judge was asking questions of the Barrick lawyer, and I was reading this on the internet. The Barrick attorney actually admitted the collusion of Barrick with the central bankers.
Well, I think for our listeners, they should understand that Blanchard is always an old-time letter writer. He's written letters and given financial advice for many, many years. And, of course, then they sued Barrick Gold Corporation for collusion and for manipulating the gold market. Wasn't that basically the theme of it?
Well, yeah, except Jim Blanchard sold out Blanchard to one of the establishment-type companies a long time ago, and then Jim Blanchard died, so he's not part of the picture anymore. But yes, Blanchard, the company, was suing American Barricks. They were really continuing a lawsuit that had started by Gold Antitrust Action Committee, and where they had done all the research and took them to court, and they really had the goods on them, but the judge threw it out of court because not that anything they said was wrong, but they didn't have standing in court, whatever that means.
Well, basically what you're dealing with is a conspiracy between the Federal Reserve System, the privately owned central banks, and, of course, the gold corporations to manipulate the price of gold, which is, of course, illegal.
Right.
But they've been doing it for years because, of course, you never want the suckers to have an even chance.
Yeah. And, Tony, you know, people have asked me many times, will they win the court battle? I said, of course they won't. But it does have a purpose because it brings attention and said the only way you can keep that type of fraud going, conspiracy, is to keep it in the dark. And so once the truth is exposed, not just to American citizens, but to citizens over the sea, especially in the African countries where the gold industry has been decimated by what these guys have done, suppressing the price, then all of a sudden the cat's out of the bag, and then they lose their control over the process. So those lawsuits do serve a purpose, a very good purpose.
Well, I'm just beginning to wonder if possibly the exposure that's come about in this case, and the one thing that most interested me was that the Barrick attorney said that this case was also, it was Blanchard versus Barrick et al., unnamed other defendants, which are now identified as the central bankers.
Right.
The Barrick attorney said that the central bankers were immune and that they couldn't be sued, and I think that's why the judge was hemming and hawing about it.
Well, I think what people have to understand is there is a class of people who are above the law, and these are the central banks of the world that really do rule the nations. And if you haven't read my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, we simply quote from Bill Clinton's mentor, Professor Carol Quigley, who explains how the central banks are able to create money out of nothing, are able to control the individual governments of the world, and these central bankers meet on a regular basis to plan our future. And, of course, there really is a ruling elite in the world. And it's about time the American people realize that and begin making preparations. We're not going to change what's going on. We have to understand that behind the central banks and behind these wicked and evil people are powerful spiritual forces. Our job is to do the best we can to protect ourselves and our families. And, of course, use the opportunity we have to make people understand the true nature of the spiritual battle in which we're engaged. Tony, we're out of time. Thanks so much for calling. And
you're welcome. Thank you.
Ron, do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
Well, I would just say that we're on the verge of a major monetary crisis. It's right around the corner, and not one in 10 Americans are ready for it because they're listening to the media and the spin masters on Wall Street in Washington, D.C., telling us we're on the verge of a turnaround, when in reality everything is getting worse and worse and worse. They're just covered up with inflated money and so forth. So people need to come to grips with, they have to sit down and study and figure out a way to do something different. If they keep doing what they've been doing, in other words, investing in paper assets, they're going to get wiped out over the next 2-3 years.
How much getting out of debt?
That's exactly right. But most people are so much in debt now that they can't do it because they're losing their jobs, so they have to find a way to invest what they have and to make a good enough return so they can get out of debt. See, I'm convinced, for what it's worth, and we didn't get into this, but Richard Russell, who's a stock market analyst, is predicting gold will surpass the Dow in the next 2 or 3 years, and that silver is going to play catch-up to gold. So in effect, he's predicting silver somewhere around $150 to $200 an ounce.
And you're talking about, of course, gold at $9,000 an ounce.
$3,000. He's saying they'll pass at $3,000.
Okay, fine. Okay, you said just surpassing the Dow, okay.
Yeah, that's right, but he's saying the Dow's going to collapse.
Oh, I see. I mean, the Dow will collapse and the gold will go up. Anyway, God bless you, Ron. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Dr.
Good night. And, of course, this is the time we just ask you to pray for America, to pray for our leaders, to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection, and if you see fit, to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters in this epic struggle to determine whether this nation will survive.
Doug.
What? Well, Dr. Stan, Randy, are you there? Well, anyway, of course, right now we're trying to get hooked up with our special guest for this evening to find out what's really going on in Sacramento. And, of course, as you know, Bill Simon has dropped out of the race. We have certainly... Bill, Tom McClintock is still in the race. Peter Ubovich is, anyway, the former baseball commissioner is still in the race. Arnold Schwarzenegger is there. And they tell us, of course, the latest polls show that Bustamante is ahead. Is that really true? Hi, Randy. How are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. I'm doing well.
Well, what's going on up in there in Sacramento? We are told that that the polls show that if the election were held tomorrow, Bustamante would win if the governor is recalled. What's the truth about what's going on?
Well, it all depends on voter turnout. The voter turnout is expected to be just a little bit higher than in November. November was the lowest voter turnout in years. So a low voter turnout in this case is going to really translate into conservative voters are going to be the bulk. And that means that actually the poll numbers do not indicate what they are. I think Bustamante is a lot lower.
All right, fine. Well, of course, now Arnold Schwarzenegger is certainly spending a lot of money. We see him first standing surrounded by Warren Buffett, a Democrat on one side, and George Shultz, a member of the establishment on the other side, longtime member of the Council on Foreign Relations, former member of the Board of Directors of the Gorbachev State of the World Forum, and certainly no friend of either Christians or America. So I'm a little bit concerned when I see the people who surround Arnold Schwarzenegger. We know he's a close friend of Reardon, who is, of course, a close friend of Simon. And, of course, it almost appears that we have a Democrat running on the as a Republican here, and, of course, undermining any possibility of getting a real good conservative into office, and that would be Tom McClintock.
Well, it's very, very interesting. I mean, since we've last talked, Simon is out of the race. I was actually quite glad for that, because when we see the splitting of pro-family folks, I'd call McClintock having the edge over Simon on a family-friendly, but in terms of what it means that if McClintock gains the Simon supporters, then McClintock will be about at the same support level as Schwarzenegger. If you add, if you look at the Schwarzenegger getting 22% in the LA Times poll, McClintock 12%, Simon 6%. Add Simon 6 to McClintock's 12. That means Schwarzenegger 22% and McClintock 18%, a statistical dead heat. At this point, I see Schwarzenegger's support topped off, McClintock's support rising.
Well, of course, Bustamante, though, is greater than either one of those two, and as long as the other two are in the race, why, Bustamante might be the victor.
He might be. However, most Latino voters don't know what he stands for. Now, most Latino voters are against Gray Davis, and an overwhelming number of Latino voters supported protecting marriage for a man and a woman, 65%, according to the LA Times exit poll 3 years ago. Now, when Latino voters find out something about Cruz Bustamante, that Cruz Bustamante actually supports homosexual marriage, I think those numbers are going to change.
But how are they going to find out? They're certainly not going to find out from the Los Angeles Times or the San Francisco Chronicle or the other controlled media outlets here in America.
Well, Campaign for California Families in 2 weeks is going all up and down the state holding news conferences. And last time we did that, we got the in 60-plus media outlets, and it was quite successful, reaching hundreds of thousands of people. And as the people's eyes are focused on where do the candidates really stand, as Schwarzenegger is being non-specific and is giving generalities, Bustamante is hiding his true agenda. I think it'll get out. Bustamante is supporting harming marriage for a man and a woman. He supports AB 205, which is the gay marriage by another name, and he has no problem rejecting the vote of the people or of the bulk of Latinos. It also shocks people when they find out that Bustamante supports fining businesses and even Bible bookstores and even the Boy Scouts $150,000 if they don't hire a cross-dressing job applicant. And this is the type of information that's quite explosive. I don't believe in personal attacks upon people, but just dealing with their positions. And that's Bustamante.
Well, I have heard, and I don't know whether it's true or not, maybe you could comment, it, that Bustamante at one time had sided with these people who wanted, of course, to bring California and New Mexico, Arizona, and Texas back under Mexican control. Is there any truth to that?
I saw a report on that recently, and I can only tell you what I saw in that report was that, and I believe the group is called MECA.
MESA, right.
Yes, that Bustamante has never disavowed his involvement and is still a member of it, I think the report said. I'm not an expert on that, but, you know, there's many shocking things that are, I think, going to come out about some of these candidates, so-called leaders in the race. I don't think you can get elected governor by specializing on what not to say. And I don't think you can be elected governor if you are trying to reach out to family-oriented Latinos, yet having your agenda really being from the Castro district of San Francisco. That's Cruz Bustamante. His voting record is unlimited abortion without parental consent, without parental notification, partial birth abortions, taxpayer-funded abortions for illegal aliens, over and over and over. He's really not showing himself to be as family-friendly as people think.
You know, it's very interesting. I was at the hospital recently and waiting to get some tests done, and a very attractive Hispanic woman was there, and she brought up the subject of the election, and she said, well, what do you think of Cruz Bustamante? And I told her, you know, of course, and obviously I suspect that she was in favor of him. And I said, well, I'll tell you why I certainly would not be voting for Cruz Bustamante, because the information I had came from something put out by Jack Wheeler, and I'll be glad to provide it for anybody that would like it. Jack Wheeler had said that Bustamante, of course, was associated with this movement that had wanted to return California and New Mexico and Arizona and Texas to Mexican control. And I said, if he then as governor succeeds in that, you'll have all the same advantages that you'd have if you live in Mexico. How would you like that? And she sort of paled, and she said, you have no advantages, you have no rights in Mexico. I said, well, then of course you're going to have to decide if that's the man you want to be your next governor. And I think that that's maybe a message that we really ought to get out, and because I think that there is a great deal of evidence that Cruz Bustamante is not, is playing the race card. He's trying to get the Hispanics behind him. But the average Hispanic doesn't understand that his loyalty is not to America, but to this, of course, a pan-Mexican dream. Well, anyway, is there anything else you'd like to talk about as far as that's concerned?
Well, I know our time is very short, and I'd like to invite people to visit our website,
right.
SaveCalifornia.com. The the homosexual marriage bill just passed its last Senate committee yesterday. It's headed to the Senate floor. We have a web-based action where you can actually just put in your name, an email address, and push one button, and you got a great email that'll go to all the members of the state legislature and Governor Gray Davis, urging them to protect marriage. That's important to do. And also to call Governor Gray Davis, and I'd like to give his phone number. His number is 916-445-2841. 916-445-2841. Urge the governor to veto two bills, AB 205, which rejects the people's vote on marriage by awarding spousal rights to homosexual partners, and then also a bill that he's really iffy about. It's the transsexual foster care bill, AB 458. AB 458, urge the governor to veto AB 458. This will mean foster parents will leave the system, less foster homes for needy children. I'm involved with a news conference tomorrow on that subject with foster parents. But it's all at SaveCalifornia.com, and there's instructions and some very easy ways for you to be involved.
All right, fine. Thanks very much, Randy. God bless you. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for your time.
Bye-bye. All right, let's go to Brad Dacus here. Hi, Brad. How are you doing?
Well, doing just great, Dr. Stanley.
Well, tell us what's going on.
Well, as everyone's watching the Ten Commandments monument issue, what we were doing behind the scenes, we at the Pacific Test Institute, is we helped draft a letter to the Justice of the Supreme Court to try to hopefully convince them, or at least some of them, to grant the stay so that the monument would be removed. Now we know that, of course, that's not the case. And the latest on it is sort of an interesting twist. We know that the Supreme Court is going to be petitioned to hear the whole case, but the interesting irony is that they can't find a company to move this heavy monument because of the promise by so many to boycott whoever does it. So that monument looks like it may be around actually for a while, because it seems like they're having a hard time finding a place to move it. But the real issue here, Dr. Stanley, is the extent to which we're going to see the ACLU move on monuments and things much more aggressively and try to have them removed, not just in Alabama, but in Los Angeles, Sacramento, San Francisco, and everywhere else.
Why do we call them the anti-Christian bigots that they are? I mean, ACLU, that's Anti-Christian Lawyers Union.
Absolutely.
And they really are. This really is an attack on Christianity. They're not out to take down the monument over in San Jose to Quetzalcoatl or whatever his name is, this Mexican god that used to require the human sacrifices. That's perfectly all right. But, of course, anything having to do with Christianity is what they hate. And, of course, they know exactly what they're doing. And the tragedy is they've got judges who will violate their oath of office and reinterpret the Constitution and the First Amendment and simply say, you know, despite the fact that the Alabama Constitution talks about Almighty God, that you can't, of course, have anything reflecting religious belief in one of the state buildings. So,
right, or the historical heritage,
right,
of the law, and it's indisputable whether people want to believe it or not, but the Ten Commandments is the foundation of Western law. And if people, you know, that's history. That's simply the foundation of history. And so if we're going to get rid of all of our historical heritage simply because people don't like the fact that it's linked with a religious belief or religious roots, that's a sad day for our, a society that's supposed to be progressive and learning and educating and grasping truth as opposed to that which it wants to not grasp.
Amen to that. Well, remember Jefferson's remarks about, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and his justice cannot sleep forever.
Right. And so anyway, if anyone needs any assistance, if their local governments are being threatened by the ACLU, or a courthouse or anywhere else because of something of significance that may or may not be related to religious heritage, I want them to feel free to contact us at the Pacific Justice Institute, and we do all our work without charge, and we represent cities and courthouses and whoever else without charge to make sure that the truth isn't trampled, which is exactly the bottom line of what the ACLU and other groups are trying to do to our heritage.
Amen to that. God bless you. Thank you for everything you do. And again, that's the Pacific Justice Institute. Do you have a telephone number you want to put out? Or?
You bet. It's 888-305-9129, 888-305. 9129, and our webpage is pacificjustice.org. That's pacificjustice.org.
Okay, God bless. Thanks so very much, Brad. We'll
Thank
talk
you.
To you later. Bye-bye. Okay, that was Brad Dacus from the Pacific Justice Institute, and of course, we've been talking about certainly the decision down there by the justices. Federal justice there in Alabama that, of course, overrode the Alabama Constitution. You have to understand that the Constitution of at least 48 states talks about Almighty God. And, of course, the Supreme Court even opens its session when the crier comes in and says, God save the United States and this honorable court. And the same thing happens, of course, in Congress. It happens in the Senate. They have a prayer. They have a in both in the Senate and in the Congress, and they actually have a chaplain who is paid to give those prayers. And of course, it says in God we trust on our coins. And of course, we can go back through the history that certainly in the Treaty of 1783, when we established our freedom from and broke our relationships with Great Britain, why that treaty talked about the Trinity. What's the Trinity? The Father, the Son, and Holy Ghost. The same thing in the Treaty of 1789, certainly in the Treaty on the Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, it talked about God. You'll find God in every aspect of our society. On four separate occasions, the Supreme Court held that America was a Christian nation. So where do these people get off, of course, saying we're not a Christian nation, we can't mention God? It's simply because they've been put into the courts for that specific purposes. And we've had presidents who have appointed people to the Supreme Court knowing full well where they were coming from. And one of these evenings I'll tell you about some of those presidents and the things that you will never hear elsewhere about them. But right now we have Shannon Horst. We're going to be on the line with us. We're going to be talking about maintaining the range. Thank you so very much for being with us, Shannon.
Yes. Glad to be here.
Why don't you go ahead and tell our listeners just a little bit about who you are? They've never heard of you before, but I have. But why don't you give them your background and then really what this is all about and how there is an organized effort, of course, to get the cattle off of the range because, of course, there are people really who want to have everything in a wilderness area, and when you have that, you have nothing but chaos. Mankind must be there to manage these various bits of nature, because if he's not there, it's like your garden. You never weed it, why, it gets overgrown very, very quickly.
Well, yes, I'm just recently the executive director, the former executive director of the Savory Center for Holistic Management, and we're based in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and we're an international nonprofit organization that works with people to help them make better decisions about how they manage their resources. And when we do that, we look at and we include the human resources, the financial resources, and also the biological resources, and we do that as a whole. And a lot of our work has been in helping rural families look at how they produce good, solid profit while building their what we call the future resource base. So in any business, you're looking at how you create a stable business from a financial standpoint without depleting your resources.
All right. Well, how would you go about doing that then?
Well, we go about doing that by really looking at really how people make decisions. And what we do is we teach them a decision-making framework where they create what we call a holistic goal, and that is a statement of how they want their lives to be in the long run and what they have to produce to have a life like that, and then what their resources have to function like in order for them to continue producing those things, therefore to have that kind of a life. And it really gets people looking at how they can get out of short-term decision-making that is, for example, very good financially, but is actually in the process of depleting their resources. And
just to give us a couple of examples of what you're speaking of.
Sure. So, for example, we have today in our modern-day agriculture, where we essentially have across all over the country and really the world soils that are being depleted. And as the natural health of the soil goes down, we put in synthetics to boost the productivity of those soils. And what that does is it increases our cost while the actual real health is going down. So we're making, we may be putting quite a bit of money in the bank and producing high profit, but in the long run, we're destroying the very basis of our business. So that's a, just one of the most glaring examples of how our decision-making process encourages us to do things that are very good in the short term, but in the long run, they're actually not creating the life we want.
Well, so what are you going to do with your land? If you're not going to plant on it, are you going to plant on it? Are you going
to get
your crops on it? Or what are you going to do with it?
No, we just work with people it's sort of one decision at a time to look at what kind of crops they're planting, what kind of animals they might be running, how they're running those animals, and to get into the a mode of really producing a process whereby each year they're looking at the trends of true health in their land, and they are determining what crops they're going to grow or what animals they're going to run or how they're going to do that based on where those trends are taking them. So in a year they may, so for example, if you were a farm family and you were facing a serious disease outbreak, you would, in this decision-making process, one of the things that you learn as a fundamental base is that a fundamental of health in landscapes is diversity. So if you're producing nothing but a monoculture, then you can almost guarantee that at some point you're going to get an outbreak.
Well, you're talking about just planting one crop.
Right.
So what
the decision-making process does is it helps people look at that and say, well, in the long run, planting this one single crop isn't actually going to take me where I want to go.
All right, well, now, we have people who have been wheat farmers for many years. What do you do as far as a wheat farmer who's been planting wheat on a farm for, for 20 years? Or maybe once in a while he leaves the fields fallow for a year or so. But then what would you tell these people that they should be doing?
Well, we can't really, one of the challenges we have in our modern day agriculture is getting into the mode of telling people specifically what they should be doing, because our society is looking for quick fixes. And often those quick fixes come out of research stations or projects that were created that didn't actually simulate a farm family. So really what we do is we focus on helping people just use a different way to make decisions. And what that will do is it will lead them to different cropping practices, a diversity of crops, because there's also a financial planning process that goes with it. So it's not a situation where we would go in and we would say, by next year, you need to wholesale rotate out of this particular crop and into these specific crops.
Well, now, of course, who actually funds your effort or your organization?
Well, we're funded really mostly by private dollars. We're funded by grant money, some, and then we also do, we have a consulting service, and we're paid a fee.
You're funded then by foundations or by corporations or by the government or what?
Yes, not very much government funding. We don't take in hardly any government funding. But we do get funded by large nonprofit foundations. Private foundations, and
are you at liberty to say which foundations at all?
Sure, I can tell you some that have funded us. The Kellogg Foundation has funded us in the past. The Hewlett Foundation out of California has funded us. The Noble Foundation out of Oklahoma. They would tend to be foundations that are really interested in the sustainability of the agriculture in this country.
So this is basically part of a sustainable development program, or what?
Yes, we do get involved in sustainable development and looking at rural communities. And also in what would be called the sustainable agriculture movement.
But of course, the average farmer is really, most of them are pretty well on the edge of financial instability. Certainly the price of crops has been down for a period of many, many years, and manipulated down by the large corporations to the point where, there's very little profit margin there. In fact, many farms are in a situation where they simply have to borrow money to buy the seed, to buy the fertilizer, to buy the various things that they need to produce the product, and hope that the crop comes in so they can pay the bank back. What do you do with the average farmer who is in that sort of a situation?
Well, it's true. The average farmer and the farm families, those that we still have left, are in a lot of them in dire straits. And it's a long history of systems that have been created, dollars that were encouraged to be borrowed, large mechanical equipment, programs where we paid for equipment and then got them hugely in debt. encourage them to go into large-scale monocrop cultures. So all of that is true. What we've found, for example, we have a survey that was taken by some professors at Ohio State University, and they did a survey of 25 families throughout the country that had essentially began using holistic decision-making for their decision-making framework. And what they found in that survey was, of those 25 families, 24 of those families documented increases in wildlife and the biological processes that were going on in their farm.
Well, that's all right as far as biological,
right.
You know, animals and wildlife, but what about their ability to survive on the farm?
Well, 21 of the 25 families documented increased productivity and profitability, and the average was 300%.
All right. Now, of course, then, what sort of things could you tell them to do? I mean, let's imagine they're wheat farmers. What sort of farmers are you talking about? Wheat farmers, corn farmers, tobacco growers, people who are planting soybeans. What sort
these
of farms
been,
are
these
they?
These would have been farmers that were in wheat, corn, soybean. Some of them had mixed operations. Most of them were in areas where probably they once were prairie, at least a lot of them. And so one of the things that they did was they brought animals back into their production.
Now, what sort of animals are you talking about?
Cattle, sheep, goats.
All right. Now, so that, in other words, they're bringing in cattle and grazing cattle then?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
And then sheep and things of that sort. So, but of course, then that would take the land out of production. Other than, of course, for grazing.
No, you would end up with a mixed operation. We have, for example, families that have created ways where they grow a crop, and then they rotate in animals and perennial grasslands. So in effect, they're getting a row crop, they're getting perennial grasslands, and they're producing also an animal. And that's really about planning and timing and decision making. It takes more attention to sitting down and working through the numbers and sitting down and working through the plan of what you're going to do than going out and fixing fence or those kinds of things. And, you know, so part of what we're doing right now as part of our farm program is what we're calling these Conservation Reserve programs, the CRP lands.
All right, we're going to be back here. I'm going to have to interrupt you. We're going to have to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty, and our guest is Shannon Horst. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Shannon Horst, and she's with a holistic planning program that is, of course, helping farmers. And, of course, this whole idea has to do with sustainable development. What about rotation? Would you have the animals certainly on an area of land for a year or two and then put that back into grain production? How would that go?
No, you would work through some pretty complex but not complicated issues of looking at when you're working with animals, what you're looking for is you're looking for what we call a graze to trample to recovery rate.
Well, now, could you explain that to our listeners most of them are not farmers. Graves, the trample to recovery. So what are we talking about?
Right. So the basic theory of animals in these environments lies in that the grassland soils and the what are called the seasonal rainfall environments, so you have periods where you have rain and moisture, and then you have long dry periods. The basic idea that we work with is that those grasslands co-evolved with large grazing, trampling animals. So the planning process that we teach people is to help them look at the time that the plant is exposed to the animal, getting what we call a trampling effect, and the trampling effect of those once were massive herds was created by the presence of the pack hunting predator, and then the grasslands had a recovery period. Because any large herd of animals that is on a piece of land will foul it very quickly and then as a bunch, because of the predator on their perimeter, they will move off of that, and they won't come back to that piece of land for until all of those minerals have cycled.
Well, now, wait a minute, you're talking about the predator, but that is not something that is present in current-day life on our farmland, is it?
No, we have to, what people learn to do in working with this process is they learn to simulate, and they learn to really look at what might have been those natural processes that were functioning.
Well, you're really talking about as it was before the white man came, when the Indians were here and the buffalo herds roamed the farmlands, the prairie?
Well, that's the kind of activity that we're working to simulate, because what we know even from recorded history, if you read this most recent book, Undaunted Courage, of the Lewis and Clark Expedition, they describe looking at some of these valleys and estimating 10,000 bison. So in our current modern-day thinking, we would say, well, 10,000 bison, these lands must have been horribly overgrazed. But they weren't. Lewis and Clark also describe perennial bunch grasses. And the reason for that is because those grasses co-evolved with those animals and the pack-hunting predator. So it's true that today, in our modern society, we have all this fence in the way, we have roads in the way, this neighbor doesn't like that neighbor, this group wants a cows out, that group wants them in. But the groups that we work with have really begun to focus not on your cows or your wildlife or my trees and your this. They've begun to focus on what series of activities that humans are engaged in and impacts that humans are engaged in produce health. And getting into a process where they work together to look at these are the management tools and activities we're going to put in place, and we're going to monitor whether or not those things are moving this piece of land toward higher biodiversity, increased soil cover, increased ability to hold water in the soil, increased diversity of plant species, and those kinds of things. And then they can begin saying, well, this year we didn't use animals, for example, and we documented that, in fact, the land is not moving in the direction we want it to. Well, why might that be? Well, maybe we need to look at incorporating animals. Okay, next year we used animals. What did we learn? And so it's really, you know, in our society today, we look at reclamation of land and rehabilitation of land, whether we're talking about a farmland or a rangeland or a forest, we look at it as if it's an event. We're going to go in one day and we're going to fix it. And that's just ludicrous, because the state of our forests, our rangelands, and our farmlands, it got to where it is over a long history of time, long process of human intervention, human impact, weather, and a mix of those things. So rehabilitation of these lands to a state where they are productive, naturally productive, not productive because we've pumped them full of chemicals. That rehabilitation it's not an event, it's a process.
In other words, you feel that the using of chemicals and herbicides or chemicals on the land is bad, and we should not use chemicals to increase production.
Well, what happens when people simply change the way they make decisions is they say, okay, in the long run, when we want our children to be healthy, we want our water to be clean, we want our air to be clean, we want our bodies to be clean. And what happens is then when they begin looking at the repeated use of synthetics, there's pretty good evidence that in the long run that doesn't produce healthy children, healthy water, clean air, etc.
In other words, then what you're suggesting, we should give up the use of fertilizers in farming.
Well,
that would be the obvious conclusion I would get from what you're saying.
Yes and no. What we're very careful about is to say, if a family one day sits down and says, we want to continue to farm, okay, but they know that the way they're currently sustainable, financially sustainable, is the system they're currently using, then they wouldn't overnight make a decision and say, oh, we're just going to quit using chemicals. Okay, and that's really, you know, there are a lot of in the sustainable ag movement and the organic agriculture movement, there is a real negative attitude towards human-made materials, synthetics, etc. What we look at is to say that we don't, biological processes are so complicated that humans don't know all the answers. And so what we need to do is we need to not necessarily say that chemicals are bad, this is good, this is bad. What we need to do is to say that all tools and actions that humans might take are possible. And the question is, does this particular action, does this chemical, does this animal, does this crop actually produce in the long run what I say I want? And if it doesn't, if my monitoring of my soils, of my water, of my air, of my children's health tells me that this activity is not actually taking me where I want to go, then we should change it. Otherwise, we're just engaged in a long process of self-suicide, basically.
I see. Well, now, aren't our children living a lot longer in the United States than they would in Africa, where they don't have such things as fertilizers and herbicides and all the things that we have here? I mean, aren't our children far more healthy than they are in more underdeveloped areas?
Sure. Our children are healthier for a lot of reasons, and some of that is that in early childhood, they are getting better food. They're getting enough food so that their brains can grow. They generally have clean water. They generally have a roof over their heads. There are a lot of, we're not as subject to pest-borne diseases. But there's also really good evidence, and there are at least some people who think that the increased incidences of cancers and tumors and things like that are directly linked to our household chemicals that we use, our fertilizers, our pesticides that we use. So, absolutely, it's true that our modern medical practices have increased our survivability rate and a lot of things. There are also other signs that doctors are picking up, scientists are picking up, that some of the things that we're using in our society in the long run are actually creating some of these things, like increased attention deficit disorder, increased autism, et cetera.
Now, what do you attribute that to? Many people attribute that to the vaccines that have been used and the mercury of the vaccine. How would you feel about that? Or, I know that's a little out of your field, but do you feel that the mercury we're giving our children has been healthy for them?
In
the vaccines,
doctors
have insisted, and the government has insisted, we give our children these shots in the nursery that contain thimerosal. For years, they've been insisting on that. Could that be what's giving the autism?
Well, I think there are lots of possibilities of that, the things that we're putting into our bodies with the idea that they're preventing something. Have the potential to create things that we're simply not aware of and that are coming further down the road. You know, there are very few, if none, of the synthetics that we've created that we can say over a long period of time we've tracked, and these have no health ramifications for humans or other species.
I see.
Now, partially that's because some of them were created more recently, and we haven't even tracked them over a long period of time.
Well, now, what about you? You're talking about fences. Are you suggesting that we not have fences to hold in the animals?
No, there are ways to use fences that are less destructive to movement of wildlife and are certainly less ugly. And one of the challenges that we face in our society in creating opportunities for farmers, ranchers, people who want to live on the land, to create these kinds of open spaces and these kinds of management processes is that we confuse ownership with management.
Do you believe in private ownership of property, or do you believe that we should just manage the property and it should somehow belong to others or the society as a whole?
Well, in the work that we do, we don't get involved necessarily in what is or is not right from a standpoint of private property rights or public property, etc. We have seen on a fairly consistent basis that people who own their land tend to care for it better and invest more in it. Now, that's not a 100% overwhelming statement. That's a tendency and a trend that we've seen. One of the challenges that you have with our current, what we call our public land system, is that it can be equated somewhat to what's known, sometimes misquoted, but used as the tragedy of the commons. Everybody's responsible for it, so nobody's responsible for it.
Then why don't we sell it off so the people can have it? If people will actually take better care of land when they own it themselves, then wouldn't we be better off to sell that range land to ranchers then who would own it and be more prone to take care of it?
Sure, if you could say that in selling it, that new buyer, that new owner would in fact take better care of it, then from that standpoint, the challenge that you would face is that currently we have, if you look at the public lands, the use and types of use is going way up. It used to be on our public lands that we had, we had grazers, we had timber people, we had mining people, and we had hunters. Now we have hikers, we have four-wheelers, we have snowmobilers. And what's happening in this country, and I think that that system itself is headed for a big crash, is that we're increasing the total acreage of land that is in public holding. We are decreasing the amount that the public actually spends, the funds that go to the Bureau of Land Management, the Forest Service, the National Park Service. We're also increasing the types of users and the actual management complexity. So in effect, you have a system that's getting larger and more complex, but actual less resources are going into it to manage it. And I think that the National Park Service hasn't run in the black, even close to in the black. It's been deeply in the red for many, many years now. And I think in the long run, that will also be a tragedy, because if we look at other countries, what you'll see is that even where you have private property laws, when land breaks down and deteriorates and people can't feed themselves anymore, national park boundaries will mean nothing. We'll begin moving into those national parks and those public lands.
Well, do you feel that we need more wilderness areas or less wilderness areas?
No, I guess what I think that we need is we need a population that better understands its connection and its relationship to all other species.
In other words, our relationship to the animals.
Right, because what we have right now is we have a culture that says, over here in this national park, I treat land, I treat animals, I treat things in a certain way. When I go home, I don't have to worry about animals, I don't have to worry about healthy soil, etc. So we separate in our mind our daily environment from this fictional wilderness area. And in doing that, we need healthy soils, healthy trees, healthy animals throughout our cities as well.
I see. Well, let's go to Joan, who's calling here. Hi, Joan. Do you have a question for our guest this evening?
Well, Dr. Stan, this is Jeannie.
Oh, Jeannie, okay.
Yeah. And this lady, I'm sorry, her name was?
Shannon Horst. She's from an organization that is a holistic management of the range, holistic management of farming, and they act as consultants to help people so that they can certainly pursue this concept of sustainable development.
Shannon Horst, you mentioned conservation reserve programs.
Mm-hmm.
Could you go into that a little bit, please?
Sure. The Conservation Reserve Program was set up with the underlying theory that when we set land aside and leave it fallow or leave it in what is sometimes called rest, it naturally recovers. Okay, so that was the underlying scientific theory behind that.
But does it work? In other words, when I leave my garden at rest, it's all full of weeds.
Well, in seasonal environments, seasonal rainfall environments, which would be about two-thirds of our continent and two-thirds of the world, it doesn't work. And it doesn't work because we no longer have the animals that were once present. So when we set land aside and that land has already been disturbed by human influences, it's been cropped or it's been grazed, but now we're going to set it aside and we're going to leave it alone. What happens is you get a flush if it's been heavily cropped. You get a flush of vegetation that occurs, and so from the view, if you're standing at the fence looking at it, you would perceive that it's healthier than it was the year before. But over long periods of time, what happens is weeds come in, the weeds take over, and it begins to revert actually to either woody, shrubby vegetation or bare ground, because the grasslands were dependent on the presence of the animals. Now, if the government in setting up the CRP program had said, you know what, this is just theory. It's just theory that if we do X with land, it will recover. So let's do this. Let's be smart. Let's say that if we're setting this land aside, what we're going to actually do is, in order for the farmer or the rancher to be paid to set this land aside, they're going to have to pull data, and they're going to have to document over 5 years, 10 years, that the land is actually improving in health. And here are some generally accepted indicators of health. Then, after 3 or 4 years, when the land actually began to revert and deteriorate, the government could have said, oh, our scientific theory might have been faulty. But we never do that. We have what we call prescriptive management, and the prescription is we believe that when we do X with land, the result is Y. We put in place laws and regulations, and we even pay people to do things that are based on nothing but scientific theory of the day. And then when it doesn't actually work 10 years later or 20 years later, we create a new program.
Well, when you go into these people that are in the rural area, and they're in, they're are kind of in a budget deficit, and they're trying to get out of it, do you go into a contract with them, or do you have a management contract with them, or do you pay them money to do this? How do you do that?
Well, what we usually do is we work really hard to not end up where a group of people, let's say in a remote area in Nebraska, end up dependent on us. And so a lot of what we do now is that we actually train trainers. And we will work with, let's say there's a group of people in rural Nebraska and they're interested in these ideas. We'll work to set up with them that, let's say there's 10 families, that we'll have a period where we're doing some training and we're doing some very specific work with them on their land and in their decision-making and planning process. But as part of that, we'll work with them to identify a couple people in their community. Those people will get trained essentially to train, to do what we would do.
Right. They're like facilitators.
They're a facilitator. Yeah. And then when families in that group change, you know, all of a sudden the son comes back and he's going to now do the farming and the dad's handing it over, but he's never done this kind of planning. They then have the capacity right there in their own community.
And you can actually increase their income as much as 300% by not planting on the farms and not planting on some of the acreage?
We have some good documentation now that when people learn the planning process, learn how to create that long-term goal, learn how to test their decisions to be sure the decisions are short-term and long-term sound, that the average increase is about 300%.
But of course, it's a thing that puzzles me just a little bit, and I may be a little dense. But if you're not, either planting weed or a crop on the land, and you're don't have any animals on the land, how are they going to make enough money? Are they going to get a grant from the government for leaving the land fallow, or what?
No, I must have confused something. They would continue to crop. They would continue to run animals. Sometimes they'll bring in animals when they wouldn't have animals before.
Okay.
What they'll do over a period of time is, let's say they're monocrop wheat. Over a period of time, they will diversify that operation. They will look for those crops, those animals, those products that give them the best return for the actual dollar input, and best return is based not only on a margin of profitability in dollars, but it's also based on, does that particular crop contribute to my long-term sustainability? So if I invest a dollar in an orchard, okay, If I'm investing, let's say, in a, we go back to looking really at the chemical use. If I'm investing dollars in chemicals, okay, in the long run, that cost is only going to go up because depleting resources of petrochemicals, those costs are going to go up. The health of my orchard is actually going down. So they just learn to really ask questions like, where's my dollar best invested in this orchard or in this animal, and to move towards greater diversity in their operation. They learn to really plan what they're doing at a fairly detailed level, and also to monitor what's actually happening. Then they have a basis going into the next year, the following year, the following year, for saying, okay, from a biological standpoint, here's where I'm at. From a financial standpoint, here's where I'm at. And from a family standpoint, here's where we're at.
So,
and they can make better decisions about the next year.
Okay, Jeannie, go ahead. Did you have a question?
Yeah. Do you actually have an agreement with the landowner that it'll be a certain amount of years that you'll be working with them?
It really depends on the landowner. We have done some where we've worked with a very, very large landowner. We've done some work with, for example, absentee-owned farms and ranches. If it's a community group, and more often we're really working with what would be called, you know, small community development groups, we figure that the training program to get somebody to where they're very qualified to stay in that community and train others is a two-year self-directed, kind of like a self-directed master's program.
Will this be something like the Global Biodiversity Assessment Report that came out of the Second Earth Summit? Are you acquainted with the Global Biodiversity Assessment? Or?
Yes, I'm acquainted with it, yeah.
Okay, and that's, of course, the basis of this whole sustainable development concept.
Sure.
Would that be a fair statement?
The basic idea is that biological diversity and the photosynthetic process is the basis of all life, including human life, and one of the things that we work with people on is understanding that it's also the basis of wealth.
You know, it's interesting, on the biodiversity assessment report that came out in 1995, when I went through it, they always said human intervention. The problem was humans that were destroying the earth. Mm-hmm. And so this has been said this evening about the humans just leave the land alone, and the humans were not to touch it. So
well, let's get Shannon's response.
Yeah, well, one of the things I was reading, in fact, recently, just in an assessment of some work that somebody had written about us and the work we've been working with children, and one of the things they said that they really liked about holistic management was that essentially the process helps humans understand where they fit and actually get very proactively involved in being part of the environment.
In other words, basically this would sort of help people to understand the part that they should play in the this sort of nature's management, the ecology. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, basically we consider humans one species among many.
Right.
Humans have the ability to make really good decisions about their relationship with all other life. We just don't learn that in our current educational systems, et cetera, and those are the kinds of things that we need to begin learning.
Well, now, how about the predators that certainly are being encouraged to reproduce in the wilderness areas? What part do they play in this overall plan that you're outlining?
Well, one of the challenges that we face with some of the efforts that we're trying to do right now is that, putting predators back into a wilderness area, obviously everybody's familiar with the challenge of how the ranchers feel about that, how farmers might feel about it, hikers might feel about it, etc. One of the challenges that we face is also that we don't have today in many of these wilderness areas the habitat that once existed to sustain those predators. So when we reintroduce an animal, it's very difficult again for us as humans to say that all of the pieces that were once in place that made this great habitat for wolves or great habitat for grizzly bears or great habitat for cheetah are all actually there. So we have to be very careful about putting an animal back if we don't know that all of the habitat is there, because if that habitat is not present, you know, this is one of the challenges that we're facing with the wolf reintroduction, is that if the deer, pronghorn, elk, bison, etc., that were once the food resource of that predator are no longer present in the numbers that they once were, if they don't behave the way they used to, then simply reintroducing the wolf isn't necessarily going to be successful. Doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. We still probably should do it from a standpoint of learning. We have so much to learn about these systems.
But it reminds me, Dr. Stan, of this nonprofit organization is very, is the same as the Resource Conservation District, where they come in and they individually go to each farmer and they tell the farmer how it should be done according to Agenda 21.
Right. But I think this is a different organization. Jeannie, I'm going to have to let you go because
we're
out of time.
Good evening.
Give me a call right afterwards. And, of course, right now, do you have a telephone number, Shannon, where people can get in touch with you and learn more about what you're doing?
Sure. The telephone number at the Center for Holistic Management is 505-842-5252.
5252. And this is all voluntary on the part of the people?
This is all voluntary, yeah, and we are not tied to Agenda 21 in any way.
Okay, fine. So that's 505-842-5252, and people can learn more about your work and what you're trying to accomplish.
They can, and there's also a website. It's www.holisticmanagement, all one word with an H, H-O-L-I-S-T-I-C, .org.
Holisticmanagement?
Mm-hmm. .org.
.org.
Mm-hmm.
You said the H...
Some people spell holistic with W-H-O-L. We use traditional spelling.
All right, fine.
H.
Hey, we're out of time. God bless you. Thanks so very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'd love to talk to you again at a little later, but right now we're out of time. Good night.
Okay.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time we certainly want to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. This is a little unusual program, but there really are people out there that have a different approach to things. I've wanted you here, Shannon. I think she's a very nice lady, very dedicated to what she's doing. And, of course, part of this whole sustainable development program that we've talked about so much in the past. Anyway, until tomorrow evening at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night. May the Lord be with you.